As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Congress appears closer to passing another coronavirus relief bill after the U.S. Senate voted yesterday, along party lines, to move the almost $2 trillion package forward. Our guest today was part of that process. We're talking with New Hampshire U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat in her first term. And this hour, we'll find out what's in that bill and what its prospects are. We'll also talk about the upcoming impeachment trial, in which Senator Hassan and her colleagues will judge whether former President Trump incited an insurrection. Exchange listeners, join us with your questions for Senator Hassan. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, or you can give us a call at 800-892-6477. And Senator Hassan joins us from her office on Capitol Hill. Senator Hassan, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, and we'll spend a fair bit of time on that coronavirus relief package because there's a lot in there. But if you could pull out one piece that you think is most important for New Hampshire, Senator Hassan, what do you think that would be?
Well, you know, the task before us right now is to respond to the crisis caused by the pandemic, both the public health crisis and the economic crisis, with the magnitude and the sense of urgency that the situation demands. And obviously, the first thing we have to do to get back to something that feels normal and to get back to a growing economy and much better employment numbers is to contain the virus. So we know that we have to get additional doses of virus distributed more quickly to everybody who is eligible for them. And that has to be our priority. But we also know that people are not experiencing this crisis in pieces. While people need to be vaccinated, they also need to put food on their table and pay their rent. Small businesses need the kind of help that has been provided in the last couple of packages, but is going to continue to need to be provided moving forward. Everybody knows that our economy will not recover and people will not be able to go back to their jobs or to fill new jobs if our schools aren't open and if there isn't childcare available. So we have to address those challenges too. And then we also know that nationwide, state and local governments have already laid off over 1 million workers. This is first line people like first responders, law enforcement, and teachers. And we have to make sure that there aren't further state and local layoffs so that, again, we don't see those budget deficits at the state or local level undermining our economic recovery. So it's really important that we see this as a complete package because the needs are intertwined. And we know we also have to help families not only make it through this, but help them engage and be active economically so that we can get the economy growing again. And that's what for instance, President Biden's package is intended to do. And that's really what the framework that we introduced yesterday in the Senate is intended to do.
Well, so let's talk about all the pieces that you just mentioned there. And you mentioned the price tag, almost $2 trillion. As you know, your Republican colleagues say that's too expensive, especially given all the money that's already gone out in economic relief. We're all watching these debt and deficit levels go up and up and up, Senator Hassan. So how uneasy are you about the size of this proposal?
So first of all, when we passed our bipartisan relief package at the end of December, we were very clear that we knew it was a relief package that would get us through the next 3 months. The unemployment benefits, for instance, expire, the extended ones expire in mid-March. And we were clear that we did this for temporary relief so that the Biden administration could get into office, get its handle around the scope of this problem, and then move forward. And so fiscal responsibility has always been really important to me. That's how we balanced two budgets in New Hampshire while I was governor. It's reflected in a number of the initiatives I've taken as a member of the United States Senate. But what we understand from economists from all perspectives is that if we do not invest in a comprehensive approach now that allows businesses and families, for instance, to plan, it will be a drag on the economy in ways that will cost us more in the long run and make it harder for us to pay back our deficit. You know, an economist from Moody's predicted that with this investment from President Biden's plan, we will reach full employment about a year and a half earlier than we would have if we didn't do anything. Economists from all perspectives and organizations like the Chamber of Commerce are supporting the general outline of the president's plan. Doesn't mean there can't be and shouldn't be some adjustments made here, because the cost of doing nothing will mean very stagnant growth. We want the economy not only to rebound from the depths of the deep recession that the pandemic caused, especially at the end of last year, but we want it to grow in 2022 and 2023 and 2024. And as the economy grows, that then allows us to address our deficit and debt.
Well, and since you mentioned the Chamber of Commerce, they did say, as you said, that, you know, they do favor a relief package, but one more focused on getting the economy going, getting people back to work. And toward that end, the Chamber said, you should focus on money for vaccine distribution, school reopening, and childcare. Setting aside for now, the Chamber said anyway, this $15 an hour minimum wage increase that is included in President Biden's package. So what's your response to that, Senator Hassan?
Well, it is really important that we focus on a comprehensive package that addresses unemployment, addresses the need for people to feed their families and stay in their homes, make sure that middle-class families get the kind of economic boost that they need, especially because some of the economic challenges that middle-class families have faced aren't always reflected in data, for instance, around unemployment. For women, for instance, who've dropped out of the workforce, even trying to look for jobs because they need to be at home with kids during remote learning, there are some real needs there that the package is intended to address. A number of people have raised issues around the inclusion of the minimum wage in this package. I have long supported an increase in the minimum wage. I think there is bipartisan agreement among the American people that folks who work 40 hours a week should be able to afford the basics of a middle-class life, you know, healthcare, a home, food on the table, and education. And so I've long supported an increase to $12 an hour. I want to understand more about why the minimum wage proposal is included as part of this package. And I'll listen to both sides about this, because we also know businesses have been struggling during the pandemic. And I want to understand from them how they think this would impact them right now. And I want to understand from the proponents of this how they would intend to phase it in. But at the end of the day, much of the package that we are talking about is a package intended to do just what the Chamber is outlining, which is really making sure that we are investing in recovery and understanding that there are so many aspects of this that are intertwined that you can't do it piecemeal.
Okay, so just to be clear, on the minimum wage, we did get an email from State Representative Chris Schultz. She's the lead sponsor of a New Hampshire House bill to create a $15 an hour minimum wage. And she asks you directly, Senator Hassan, will you support a $15 minimum wage in the Senate? Sounds like the answer to Representative Schultz is no.
Right now, what I have said is that I would support $12. I will obviously listen to folks who want to convince me otherwise. But I do think it's important that we understand how New Hampshire businesses feel this would impact them. The most important thing here is to get a robust increase to the minimum wage because so many hardworking Granite Staters are literally living at the poverty level, even though they're working 40 hours a week. And that's just not right in the United States and in New Hampshire.
Thanks for writing, Representative Schultz. And here's a call from Molly in Exeter. Hi, Molly. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in today.
Hi. Thank you for having me. And hi, Senator Hassan.
Hi, Molly.
I have a question. I serve on the select board here in Exeter, and we are looking at, you know, sort of some unknowns. And I was wondering if you could address what aid will be going to state and local governments, especially municipalities here in New Hampshire, in any of these proposals.
I'm glad you called, Molly, because this is a difference between, right, Senator Hassan, the Democratic bill and the Republican bill. The Republican approach does not include aid to state and localities.
Right. The current proposal that the 10 Republican senators brought forward, and these are Republicans I've done a lot of work with, and most of them were part of the bipartisan negotiations that we did back in November with our Common Sense Coalition. I am glad that they have come forward with a proposal. I am glad that the president met with them on Monday night. And I think the discussions that we're having are really important. And I'm hoping that some of them will make suggestions about the proposal that we're putting forward in the Senate and see if we can work together to agreement on what that overall proposal should look like. To Molly's specific question, I have been advocating for state and local aid since the pandemic hit, because we know, particularly right now for our local governments, how hard hit they have been in terms of mobilizing public health response, dealing with some of the issues, whether it's rental assistance or people not being able to put food on their table. Our local governments often respond to that. And obviously, our local school departments have been very challenged by this. We know that localities and states need help. And one of the things that our Republican colleagues are talking about us with, and we're talking with the White House about, is how do you come up with the right kind of formula that really addresses not only state needs, but local needs in a way that makes sure that the money gets to the localities and states that clearly need it and really will be used to make sure that there aren't further layoffs. Perhaps we can rehire some people who have been laid off and we can invest in the kind of local response that will help us get the vaccinations done and then help us with the economic recovery.
You know, when we've talked to Republicans about this discrepancy, they've said, hey, there is money in this bill for states and localities. It's just not a specific carve out. So there's money for public health that goes to states and localities. There's money for public schools that goes to states and localities. There's money for small businesses that goes to, you know, the state and local level. So why do state and local governments need sort of a special carve out?
Well, because through no fault of their own, they had to close down large parts of their economy, which produce revenue that funds state and local services. And so different states have had different experiences with this, and that's one of the reasons we're looking at this closely to try to understand what the actual experience on the ground is. But there are critical services, whether they are school services, whether they are other municipal services, whether they're law enforcement or EMT services, that are funded by revenues that have been impacted. When you think about how reliant many municipalities are, for instance, on rooms and meals tax revenues, when those revenues have declined, given that so many restaurants and hotels, for instance, have been shuttered for at least a part of this pandemic experience, it behooves us to look at that so that there is enough general revenue for these state and local governments to fund these critical services.
Here's an email from Cliff talking about the process by which this bill is going through the Senate. Cliff says, it seems the COVID relief bill may present a moment for the middle in the Senate. Do you worry that pressing for the full $1.9 trillion through reconciliation will squander what seems like a rare opportunity? Why not prioritize, Cliff says, what is in the bill and meet somewhere toward the middle? And just to clarify, Senator Hassan, for those who aren't familiar with the rules of the Senate, reconciliation means Democrats can push this thing through without Republican support. And there's a lot of discussion about this right now. So go ahead, please.
Well, sure. So first of all, I have always supported bipartisan work and bipartisan solutions because I think they include so many different perspectives and they tend to build better and more sustainable solutions to problems. So I hope very much that at the end of the day, This COVID relief package will in fact be a bipartisan effort. And over the course of the history of the Senate, while there's characterization of the budget reconciliation process as being a partisan one, there have been, I think, 17 instances where it's been a bipartisan one. There's nothing that precludes Republicans from voting for parts of this package or all of this package through the budget reconciliation process. The difference here is that this is a package that has large bipartisan support throughout the country. Democrats, Republicans, and independents have all been hit hard by this pandemic. And what is interesting to see is how many Americans agree that we need comprehensive relief. We need it now. And not only should it be comprehensive in terms of the various challenges that we're facing. We want to address them all together because they're intertwined in this pandemic that we are in. But it's important that it be a long-term enough solution so that businesses and individuals and schools can plan. For instance, the $600 billion plan that the Republicans presented to the president would only take unemployment benefits through June. So we'd get this passed. Currently, expanded unemployment benefits run out mid-March. We'd get this passed and people would know now from March to June, they're covered. What the president's plan does is take that through September so that people can plan their future and understand what's before them. In terms of budget reconciliation, we have started that process because of the urgency of this moment, because unemployment runs out in mid-March, and we don't want ongoing negotiations to slow the process down so much that we come up against deadlines that we fail to meet.
So negotiations are one thing, but the way that this was done, the reconciliation, correct me if I'm wrong, allows Democrats to skirt the 60 vote requirement and just pass with a simple majority vote. This passed yesterday on a party line. So again, to Cliff's question, you know, it seems, as he says, you may be squandering a rare opportunity to demonstrate true bipartisanship by kind of pushing this through under these special rules. I think that's what he's getting.
Let's be clear. These rules are used. They were used by our colleagues when they were in the majority to move through things too. So it is not as if, and they have been used historically in a bipartisan way as well, sometimes with only one party. I think what is important here is to remember that President Biden was elected to address this pandemic challenge and to hit the ground running. And what we don't want to do is delay the work that we need to do to get to a final package. There is nothing all we did this week is start this process. Then after the budget resolution is passed, the work goes off to our committees where we can engage in a bipartisan way on what the details of this package would look like. We can make amendments to it. Republicans can come to Democrats and Democrats can go to Republicans and say, isn't there a better way than what was outlined in the initial proposal to do X, Y, or Z? And we can come up with a bipartisan approach. And then the final package that is passed can reflect that. It is also possible at the same time to start a package through the regular order. And we can have two processes going at once. And again, people can decide whether the bipartisan package that might come out of that is a better one. But what is really important here is that we meet the moment with the urgency that it demands. And we know that we need to get to work on it now. And that's why we started the process we did. But we are hopeful that we will continue these negotiations and discussions with our colleagues and that we will be able to craft a bipartisan solution.
Well, we've got a call from Gail in Stratham. Hi, Gail. You're on the air with Senator Hassan. Thanks for being on The Exchange today.
Great. Thank you so much. Good morning, Senator Hassan. This is Gail Davis.
Hi, Gail. How are you?
I am well. How about yourself?
Good, thanks.
Good. So I own a business that provides in-home services to veterans in New Hampshire. And I was wondering that, with your priorities, what your priorities will be for New Hampshire veterans now that you're on the Senate Committee for Veterans Affairs.
Well, thank you so much for the question, Gail. Thank you for the work that you and all of the employees of your home care service do for so many people, including our veterans. And yeah, I'm really excited that it was just announced yesterday that I will now be a member of the Senate Veterans Committee. Among the priorities that I have are to continue the work I've been doing to make sure that the Veterans Administration is required to reach out to active duty members who are transitioning to civilian and veteran life about what programs are available through the VA. What we find is often people transitioning don't really initiate the interaction with the VA themselves and don't know what benefits and supports they're eligible for. So there's something called the Solid Start Program, and I wanna strengthen that and codify it in law. I also wanna make sure that the VA is working for our veterans, and given New Hampshire's particular challenges, not having a full service VA, that we are doing everything we can to get healthcare to veterans as effectively as possible. And there are a number of other things. I know, Laura, we're coming up on a break, but I think the other critical thing that I hear about from veterans organizations throughout New Hampshire is our concern about mental health challenges and suicide generally among veterans, as well as among some active duty members. And we need to have stronger services and a stronger understanding of how we can prevent that. And the Green Alert Bill that I introduced last Congress with Senator Ernst is something I plan to reintroduce to make sure that we can save as many lives of veterans dealing with mental health challenges as we can.
Yeah, that's a longstanding issue that we've definitely focused some of our attention on as well. So I'm glad you called, Gail. Thank you very much. And we will take a very short break, but when we come back, we will talk about impeachment, heightened political rancor on Capitol Hill. We'll also cover vaccines and a lot more of your questions. So keep them coming in. It's 800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More with U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with New Hampshire Democratic U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan, who recently announced she's running for re-election. We're looking at issues from coronavirus, economic relief, to the upcoming impeachment trial. And listeners, it's been great to hear from you. Join us by email exchange at nhpr.org, use Facebook, or call 800-892-6477. Again, 800-892-6477. Senator Hassan, before we turn to impeachment, I did want to ask you about vaccines. Given your position on the health, education, and labor community, and as you know, here in New Hampshire, many people seem very eager to sign up to get vaccinated, but their appointments are weeks or months away because there's just not enough supply. What happens, Senator Hassan? Why isn't there more? I know that's sort of a big mega question, but I'd love your perspective.
Well, thanks for the question. And first of all, I am very glad that so many people in New Hampshire are doing everything they can to get vaccinated, because we know how important that is to ending this pandemic, really getting it under control. So thank you, New Hampshire, for being so vigilant about it. We know that we need to do more. What we did at the end of the year in the bipartisan package that I was part of was allocate $9 billion more to support vaccine distribution. But we also know that there's still a lot of demand out there that is unmet. The Biden administration has acted really quickly since coming into office to address the vaccine rollout problems, including they recently secured 200 million more vaccine doses. And I think the news this morning is that they are working directly with some pharmacy chains now to get some of those doses directly to pharmacies to, again, increase the number of sites available and the number of people to do the vaccinations available. They're also trying to set up and planning to set up 100 sites run by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, across the country. And they are recruiting, for instance, retired doctors and nurses to come out of retirement to help administer the vaccines. So there is a lot more they need to do. But they have hit the ground running. They do know it's a problem. And we do know how important it is to get vaccines in arms here so that we can begin to contain this virus. And I would encourage people, there are issues we are hearing about from constituents with second doses in particular. We are in touch with the state, which administers the vaccine distribution. Federal government's responsible for getting the state the vaccines. Then the state is responsible for the distribution plan. But they are aware of the second dose issue. They encourage people to keep checking for second dose appointments on the website or to call 211 with help for that.
Well, and NHPR has been tracking this story closely. So for now, I'll just say stay tuned for more of that. Both the exchange and our news department have been on top of this story. Sure. I want to go back to our listeners, Senator Hassan. And this is Mackenzie from Merrimack. Hi, Mackenzie. Thanks for calling in today. You're on the exchange.
Thank you for having me. And
sure.
Good morning, Senator Hassan.
Hi, Mackenzie.
My question for you this morning is, do you think it would be possible to pass bills through Congress now that address the cost of prescription drugs?
High prescription drug costs. And Mackenzie, I'm glad you called, because honestly, almost every single time we have a member of Congress on, whether it's you, Senator Hassan, Senator Shaheen, Congressman Pappas, Congresswoman Custer, we get calls and emails from people about high prescription drug costs. So, wow, why is this such a stubborn problem, Senator Hassan? And can you address Mackenzie's question specifically?
I thank Mackenzie for the question. And it is, to your point, Laura, a question we get a lot for a good reason, because the cost of prescription drugs for so many Granite Staters is too high. So one of the things we were able to do in a bipartisan way in the summer of 2019 in Congress was pass a bipartisan bill that would lower the cost of prescription drugs through our Finance Committee. Now, it didn't get over the finish line, and it didn't have everything in it that I might support, but it was a really important first step. And I'm hoping that this is one of the things we'll be able to do in this Congress, is take that bipartisan bill, get it over the finish line, and help people with the cost of prescription drugs. There's obviously more to do. That bill doesn't, for instance, address the possibility of allowing Medicare to negotiate the cost of prescription drugs, nor does it provide for the importation of safe and properly vetted drugs over the border, for instance, from Canada. So those are things we need to continue to look at. But overall, the cost of healthcare remains too high. One of the other bipartisan things that I was able to do in the last Congress that we did get over the finish line was to end the practice of surprise medical billing. That's something I worked on with my colleague, Senator Cassidy from Louisiana, for over the last 2 years. And we really built a coalition in Congress in both chambers that said this is ridiculous when patients get a bill that is because the provider they saw at one of their in-network hospitals, for instance, the provider themselves wasn't part of the insurance network and the patient got stuck with the bill.
Does that have to do with prescription drugs, or is that more
about
hospital visits?
No, it's overall about the high cost of healthcare. Prescription drugs is a part of it. Things like surprise medical billing is a part of it. And one of the things we were able to do by ending that practice, the bill will become effective next January, is save the federal government $18 billion, which we now are able to invest in our community health centers, which is another place where people can go for healthcare at a lower cost. So overall, prescription drugs are a big issue. So is the overall cost of healthcare.
Yeah, and boy, the cost of healthcare, it's such an important issue. And it's one of those issues, Senator Hassan, where there's so many important things that have been set aside by the pandemic because, you know, we've got to solve that first. So I really appreciate the question, Mackenzie, and stay tuned, if I could put it that way. I do have to ask you, Senator Hassan, about impeachment before we go much further. The Senate is getting ready for an impeachment trial to take place next week. You issued a statement a week after the violent attack on the Capitol saying the president must be held accountable. How are you getting ready for this trial, Senator Hassan?
Thanks for the question, Laura. January 6th was one of the grimmest days in American history. To take people back, This was about an armed mob breaching the Capitol and attempting to stop Congress from doing its constitutionally mandated duty to count votes that had been certified by the states, total those votes up, and then certify the vote. This is part of our peaceful transition of power that we have done every 4 years since we started transitioning presidencies. So it was a really serious insurrection. Obviously, we lost a Capitol police officer who we are mourning today at the Capitol. We have lost two other law enforcement members to suicide since the Capitol attack. And there were civilians who lost their lives as well. And so it's critically important that we understand what happened. The House impeached the president shortly thereafter based on House members' own experience, but also all the information that was available in reporting and on video. And then the Senate has a constitutional obligation after an impeachment happens to have a trial about it. I certainly believe from what I know, what I saw that day, the reporting I've seen, the video that I've seen, that the president instigated this attack on the Capitol and violated his oath to the Constitution. I want to hear the arguments that the president's lawyers will make, as well as the House managers, about whether to convict and about whether, if a conviction takes place, to bar the former president from running from office again. But this is a nation of laws, and nobody is above the law, including the president of the United States. So it's important to hold him accountable for his actions. It is also really important to protect our Constitution moving forward, because future leaders should understand that they'll be held accountable for what they might do in the last days of office themselves. So this is not only about holding a former president accountable, but it's making clear that we will move to protect our Constitution and our democracy from future attacks as well.
Well, speaking of moving forward, and I'm sure you've heard this, Senator Hassan, some legal experts have said pursuing this trial after the president has left office could set a bad precedent, paving the way for Republicans to pursue impeachments of future Democratic leaders that they oppose. So I wonder what you think about that.
Well, first of all, let's just stay focused on the fact that we also have to address pandemic relief moving forward. So the impeachment is important. It's a part of our constitutional obligation, and it's important to protect our democracy. It is also important that Congress move forward and deal with the pandemic, which is, of course, our most pressing need and the most pressing need that we've seen as a country in generations. The argument that you just outlined is an argument that people often make about impeachments generally. The Constitution is clear that if an impeachment happens, then the Senate has to have a trial about it. The Senate has in the past had trials of officials who have since their impeachment left office. And most constitutional experts believe that the Senate has to act once the House is impeached. So that's
interesting. Okay, yeah. So just twice, Senator Hassan, you said that the House did this. So, of course, under the Constitution, we, the Senate, have to do it. So I hear you on that. Do you wish that the House did not do this? Is this getting in the way of President Biden, you know, taking the reins and grappling with this pandemic?
You know, on this issue, I agree with Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney. If what the president did in inciting a mob, which is what it appears that he did, after he had spent months propounding false claims about election fraud, I don't know what else is impeachable. And again, we all took an oath to protect the Constitution of the United States. Members of the House of both parties voted to impeach the president based on what they understood to have happened on January 6th. And so now we have our obligation. But again, it's really important that when a president of the United States appears to use every tool at his disposal to undermine a fair and free election, for the purpose of staying in office himself. That's exactly the kind of behavior that our founders were concerned could happen. And that's why they provided the impeachment option to Congress. So again, when I look at the history and what the founders wrote, and when I listen to leaders like Congresswoman Cheney and other Republicans too, including Senator McConnell, who expressed his concerns about the president's behavior and has opined that it is perhaps impeachable behavior, I don't know that Congress had much of an option.
Well, so here's an email from Pam, and this gets to what we've been talking about, the insurrection, the violence. Pam says, I think I saw or heard somewhere that there are specifically, that there are actually no specific crimes related to domestic terrorism. Pam asks, so the people who attacked the Capitol have to be charged with some sort of generic crime, such as trespassing or vandalism. If this is true, Pam asks, can we get some laws on the books making domestic terrorism a specified crime on the level of international terrorism? And Pam, I'm glad you wrote, because Senator Hassan, I think you still sit on the Homeland Security Committee, so I know you're looking at this.
Yeah, we certainly are, because what happened on January 6th was domestic terrorism. Let's be very clear about that. And even before what happened on January 6th, what we had been hearing from FBI Director Wray, for instance, in our national security briefings and our Homeland Security briefings, was that domestic terrorism, and specifically terrorism based on a white supremacy ideology, was one of our biggest, gravest threats. It's something we have to address, something I have been working on, as have other members of Congress in both parties. We will have hearings, I know, on this issue in our judiciary hearing, in our Homeland Security hearing, and likely in our committee, and likely in our intelligence committee as well. I will say that one of the things that has impacted the way domestic terrorism is addressed in our criminal code is that there have always been free speech concerns around how you detect and define domestic terrorism, how you separate words from actions. And that's one of the things that we'll need to consider and address carefully. Any legislation is tailored narrowly to really make sure that we're giving law enforcement the tools they need. There are people who say law enforcement has all the tools it needs. This is more about information sharing and coordination than it is about having a domestic terrorism statute on the books. But that's why we're going to have hearings, because obviously it's of grave concern.
Oh, that's interesting. So I was reading something from ProPublica, which says federal authorities have had more success combating international terrorists than those with a domestic focus, reflecting legal limits on investigations of American political groups. According to this article, one fundamental problem is, this is kind of what you said, Senator Hassan, is while federal statutes provide a definition of domestic terrorism, there is not a specific law outlawing it. Is that right?
That's essentially my understanding. Again, it isn't that we can't prosecute people for taking actions that are terrorist actions.
After the fact.
Domestic ideology. We do define domestic terrorism in statute, but because of concerns around free speech and about who might be the subjects of prosecutions about this, there have been conflicting ideas about how best to address the growing threat of domestic terrorism. But let's be clear, regardless of whether we have a specific statute on the books, the behavior of the domestic terrorists on January 6th, the behavior of domestic terrorists, domestic terrorist on in the Oklahoma City bombing, for instance, behavior of domestic terrorists who attack places of worship is not only an outrage, it is against the law in the United States and should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Well, I guess the problem is, though, you know, everybody understands, well, most people understand these actions are illegal once they're taken. The problem is getting to them before those actions are taken.
Right. And that's part of the ongoing issue too, though, of information sharing and and responding to threats that we see as if they are real threats and not just idle chatter, right? And so that also speaks to the focus of our law enforcement, to the understanding that they have about this threat and what some of the information that they might see really means. And that's part of what we want to examine and investigate and respond to in Congress.
All right. Well, Senator Hassan, I have a lot of questions from listeners about climate change, so I'll throw those at you after a short break. Also, I'm hoping we can talk a little bit more about getting schools to open. So listeners, join us with your comments, questions. Again, our phone number, 800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire Democratic U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan is here, and we're taking your questions by email at exchange@nhpr.org, by Facebook, or by calling 800-892-6477. And Senator Hassan, right back to the listeners, and Griffin's calling from Rawlingsford. Hi, Griffin, you're on the air. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Senator Hassan, thanks so much for joining us. My name is Griffin. I actually helped turn out the youth vote for UNH in 2016. While I was there, I racked up thousands of dollars in student debt. And as you know, New Hampshire students graduate with the highest average student debt in the country. Forgiving student debt would make a huge difference to me and my friends to be able to start businesses and buy homes, not to mention the broader economic support, which seems to be more pressing every day. When Biden was in New Hampshire, I actually heard him talk about canceling student debt, and now he's pushing Congress to cancel $10,000 of student debt per borrower. A little clear yes or no answer. Is this something that you support?
And Griffin, first, how much student debt? Sorry, I'm just going to clarify. How much student debt, Griffin, do you think should be canceled? All of it, or half of it, or $10,000? I mean, what's the limit here?
I think if we canceled all of the student debt, or at least $50,000, we would see some really powerful economic stimulation in our economy. And that would be really powerful. I know what Biden's calling for is $10,000. I think that's not a bad start. Would love to hear what the senators think.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in. Go ahead, Senator Hassan.
Well, first of all, Griffin, thanks so much for your efforts. And thank you for calling in. And look, yes, student debt is a huge issue. It's something I have been concerned about since I got into public life, and something I worked to take action on as governor and continued to work on as senator. One of the things, for instance, I've heard from UNH students, but students all over New Hampshire, is the burden of student debt, for instance, can prevent them from deciding to start their own business after school, because that risk-taking isn't something that they feel that they can do given the amount of student debt they have. And that's why I introduced a bill to defer or forgive student debt for students who start their own businesses. I've also worked to expand Pell Grant and improve the financial aid process and make sure that students who are eligible for public service student loan forgiveness are helped much more significantly by the Department of Education when they go to do that. As to the specifics here, I do think it's really important that we look at making sure that we target student loan forgiveness. I want to understand better from President Biden how his particular proposal would work and who would be getting the student debt relief. And I want to make sure that we approach this in as bipartisan a way as we can. But I certainly understand the issue, and I'm looking forward to getting more details from President Biden.
So no specifics yet on $10,000, $50,000, all of it. You want to look at who's getting that forgiveness, for example, kids who come from wealthy families or so forth and so forth.
That's right. I mean, I want to make sure that we're targeting it as effectively as possible. But I do understand the burden it places on so many young people and the drag that that burden has on economic growth.
Okay, so Griffin, nothing quite specific yet, but stay tuned to that issue. I'm glad you called, though, Griffin, because I did want to talk also about education And so much conversation now, Senator Hassan, about just the enormous toll that the pandemic has taken on kids, you know, academic, social, their mental health. There's some real concerns among pediatricians about what this is doing to our children. And teachers tell us they want to get back into the classroom, but they want to be vaccinated. Lucy writes to us saying her mother is a teacher in Sanborn. She wants to know, do you think teachers should be vaccinated in phase one instead of phase two? And what are the implications of postponing the vaccination of educators until phase two for the residents of New Hampshire? And Lucy, thank you for writing.
Well, Lucy, I thank you for the question too. And I thank all of the educators out there, teachers, paraprofessionals, school administrators, and sanitation and custodial staff at schools that have been physically open too, because this has been a year like no other for New Hampshire's students, their families, and the educators who've worked so hard to make remote learning work. In some parts of our state, for instance, where there hasn't been universal broadband access for students, we have students, we have educators who have been delivering packages to their students at home so that they can get their schoolwork done. And we've certainly had school bus drivers and others participating in food distribution too, to make sure that students who usually get their biggest meal of the day at school can continue to get nutrition. So first of all, just a real shout out to the entire education community for everything that they've done to try to make this work. And a shout out to our families and our students too. This has been really hard. We need to reopen schools as quickly and safely as we can. And that's one of the priorities in the plan that President Biden has put forward and the plan that the Senate began to advance this week. It's gonna be really important that schools have the resources to have fewer students in bigger space to be safe. And it's going to be important that schools have the resources to address kind of pent up educational demand. For some students, remote learning has been okay. For other students, it really has left them with learning gaps. And for students, especially with special needs and disabilities, they have really not been able to progress the way they usually can because they haven't been able to have the in-person supports that are so important to that progress. So we need an
What about vaccinations?
So, and I'll get to vaccinations next.
Yeah.
But again, all of this is of a piece, right?
We're talking about resources. So should vaccinations be part of that?
Right.
That's the question.
Resources, right. And so resources should be, vaccination should be a part of this solution. I think it has been right to prioritize frontline essential workers and healthcare workers at the front of that line because of the importance of the work they do in containing the virus and because they are the most likely to be consistently exposed to the virus. But having said that, there are other essential workers. I believe teachers are essential workers. And I believe that if they are vaccinated, it will help us accelerate the reopening of schools. And so I think that that should be a priority. And I know that in some states it is.
All right. And I want to turn to climate change, Senator Hassan, in the few minutes we have left, because we received a lot of emails from listeners on this. And I apologize, I won't be able to read all of them. But here's one from Michael in Lee, who says, there are a lot of proposals to address climate change. Michael says, how can you make sure that climate legislation is both strong enough to do the job and won't be overturned next time Republicans are in charge? And Michael, thank you for writing. And Senator Hassan, I would just add to that, if you could see one meaningful piece of climate legislation become law, what would that be?
Oh, well, thanks for the question, Laura. And I'm just gonna start by agreeing with so many Granite Staters that climate change is an existential threat. It's a threat to our economy, to our environment, to our jobs, and yes, to our very way of life. I am really pleased that the Biden administration wasted no time in rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement because that's critical to getting international agreement to reduce carbon emissions and address climate change. There has been bipartisan agreement in Congress over the years about measures we could take. And to your caller's or emailer's point, sustainable ones. So for instance, around the issue of energy efficiency, which is really, wasted energy or energy inefficiency is a major cause of carbon emissions and impacts climate change. There has been bipartisan agreement on ways to incentivize and grow our green economy. But we also know that we have to do more. And it's why you see many of us supporting efforts that I think will be led by Secretary-designate Jennifer Granholm in the Department of Energy to move to electric vehicles, for instance. So I think there is growing bipartisan interest in moving forward to address climate change. It's going to be important to the caller's point to do this in ways that can gain as much bipartisan support as possible so we sustain this effort over the long term.
Let's take another call. This is Walter in Exeter. Hi, Walter. You're on The Exchange with Senator Hassan. Go ahead, please.
Hey, how you doing? You know, earlier in the show, the senator cited support for the Democratic COVID relief bill from a broad consensus of economists and the Chamber of Commerce as evidence that it was good policy, and I don't disagree with that. But on climate change, the same two groups, virtually all economists, whether left or right, and the Chamber of Commerce most recently, believe that putting a price on carbon is the single best way to reduce the emissions. So can we count on Senator Hassan to push for pricing carbon, ideally with a carbon fee and dividend that rebates all the fees back to Americans so it doesn't harm the economy, as the first and most important climate legislation in this session? It's probably the only significant policy that really also has a chance of getting any votes from the other side, which is going to be necessary to push things through in a pretty evenly divided Senate.
Okay, so Walter, thanks for calling. We got lots of emails on this specific proposal, carbon pricing, sometimes called a carbon fee and dividend, as Walter said, or a carbon cashback program. So thank you, Walter. And go ahead, Senator Hassan. Yes or no? Is this something you'll support?
Walter, I thank you for the question. We are reviewing the proposals that are being made. In this type of proposal, details do make a difference, but it is one of the things that I hope we can build bipartisan support for. I do want to understand the details, and I do want to hear if there are people who oppose this, what their opposition is. One of the things I was really proud of in my work in the state Senate was helping getting the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative over the finish line and into law in New Hampshire. And I understand the general approach here in terms of trying to provide incentives for carbon emission reductions.
Is there a potential link between pandemic recovery and climate action, Senator Hassan?
Would you repeat the question? Is there a link between?
Yeah. Is there a connection between pandemic recovery and all the things that will be going on to try to help the economy, you know, pull itself back up? All these bills that we talked about at the top of the show. Is there a link between any of that effort and climate action, you know, reducing some of the impacts of climate change? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, no, look, we know that there is great potential in investing in in green energy jobs and in a clean energy economy. So as we are, for instance, focusing on how to get our workforce back up and into good paying jobs, one of the things we should focus on is workforce training in new areas, and the green economy gives us a great opportunity to do that. One of the bills that I have in, a bipartisan bill with Senator Collins and Young and Kane, is called Gateway to Careers. And that would help people while they're working in one job, or if they are out of work, learn new skills, new trades. We also have apprenticeship programs in New Hampshire with manufacturers who want some help training up people to do these new jobs. And there are federal funds for those types of apprenticeships. So I think there's a real opportunity here to help people who are unemployed and looking for new work as we come out of this pandemic to learn the skills that we need to create the kind of clean energy that we want. And it's a really important synergy and a really important opportunity for people to train up for good paying jobs.
Well, and there is just so much in front of us. So I appreciate the answer. John from Rye has a more personal question for you, Senator Hassan. He wants to know, what was the inauguration like given the heightened security after the riots at the Capitol? John, thank you for writing.
John, that's a great question. And I thank you for asking it. And I took great hope and just felt great celebration at President Biden and Vice President Harris's inauguration. You are right. The security was intense, and I wish it hadn't been necessary. I also want to thank all the National Guard as well as law enforcement from the entire region for all the work that they did, including New Hampshire National Guard, by the way, to keep us safe. But what I took from the inauguration was that despite what had happened on January 6th, despite an attempt to interfere with the peaceful transition of power, and it actually for several hours on January 6th did interfere with the peaceful transition of power, Americans stood strong. Congress stood together in completing its task and certifying the election. And President Biden and Vice President Harris insisted that the inauguration would go forward in the same place that it has gone forward throughout most of our history. And it was a demonstration of American competence and optimism and strength. And I found great solace in it. I particularly loved the poet Amanda Gorman. I thought her poem was wonderful. I thought her spirit was infectious. You know, just it made everybody smile. And, you know, it was a sober day in some ways because of the security, or a somber day, I guess I'd say. But it was a really important one okay. for American resilience.
And yeah, and sorry I have to jump in on you there, yeah. Senator Hassan, but I really appreciate you being with us today. Thank you.
I really appreciate you having me. Everybody stay safe and be well and continue to wear your masks and practice social distancing. We're going to have to do this.
That's New Hampshire U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan, and this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.